Yeah, that sounds fucking lovely. Let's
awesome.
Go.
Awesome. Let's go. Cue the music. It's episode 16 of the Branching Factor podcast, brought to you courtesy of the wonderful people over at Model AI. It's late on a Friday night here in the UK. It's not so late over in Seattle, out in the good old United States of America, where we've got today's wonderful guest, Will Overcard, a.k.a. the Viking Blonde, with us. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing bloody splendid. Although I can't imagine this is the accent people are expecting from Seattle, Washington.
Hello, reporting you live from Seattle. It's like, you know, hanging out with Fraser Crane or whatever. Let's not get there.
He's just around.
Toss salad, scrambled
eggs. Awkward, actually. It's kind of like the dodgy bloke down like the local Tesco that's always just around. You're not supposed to look at him. Thank you for having me.
I do appreciate, though, because I think this is one of the first times that one of the guests has actually heard the intro music as we're starting it up. And immediately I'm like, you get this. You get the energy that I was going for with this. Because sometimes other people have heard it and they're like, that's a bit intense. I'm like, no. We need to wake the fuck up and get this going. Like, let's do this.
This is the 2D fighting intro I was always promised growing up.
Ooh, that is a good... So, funnily enough, like, when I spoke to Ben, Ben Ridge, who did the music for me, who was also the guest on our previous episode of the podcast, I said to him when we were talking about it, I says, I'm really thinking Capcom CPS2 era fighting games and the Transformers 1986 soundtrack.
Yeah.
And he was like, I don't know what half of those things are, because he's like 32 or something, 33. And I'm like, fuck me. So I went and got like, go. He's like, all right, I know what the touch is. I'm like, right, okay, that's a start. That's Stan Bush. Can't go wrong. Like, here's the rest of the soundtrack, but also just go and listen to like Street Fighter Alpha soundtrack or like Marvel and X-Men versus Street Fighter and all this sort of stuff. And what, that's the kind of energy. And then he's like, okay, I got this. And then there we go. We got it.
But anyway, spot on.
So the Branching Factor podcast, we're here as experts to demystify all things games. And we discuss it in a moderately intelligent way and hopefully also somewhat like intellectually and entertainingly. More adjectives, really, but stuff will happen. We will drink coffee.
I'll do you two out of three tops.
That's one better than I was expecting, so we'll take it. And that's not because of our wonderful guest. It's just because I'm a moron. And what we're trying to do is we have to have more and more people come on as guests on the show who do stuff beyond what I do. So myself and like the rest of the co-host team, whether it's Quang and George, we're all working in the industry in some way, in some shape or form. But I just want to find more and more cool people that I already know, and then we'll find cool people that I don't know, and then we'll bring them on as well. And then I thought, right, so Will is like a totally obvious one to bring on because... one, Will's awesome. Two, Will does really interesting stuff. Three, we didn't speak to each other for like almost a decade, and then we bumped into each other at GDC last year and then had like the funniest interaction, which is actually funnier the longer you unpack it. Because actually the moment that we spoke to each other was just like, oh, hey, how you doing? Because...
yeah.
So, right, let's wind the clock back.
On track.
March 2023, we're in the middle of a bomb cyclone.
Yeah, which was a thing I found out that exists as it happened to us.
Right. So I'd just been to a mixer for an AI thing, for an AI company called Hidden Door, who are at GDC next week. They're giving a talk at AI Summit. If you're going to GDC, tune in. Hillary Mason's talking. I think it's going to be really interesting. But I'd been at that event, and then I'd just been, I was supposed to be going to another event that Riot were hosting. So, but there was no cabs, and I didn't know why. I'm like, I'm looking at the Uber, and I'm like, well, I can't get a cab. What the heck's going on? I'm going to have to walk for 30 minutes. I get out the restaurant, and it's raining sideways.
Yeah. For those who haven't experienced it, so a bomb cyclone is all the effects of a cyclone in about 2 hours, and then it's done. This flipped a truck over on one of the bridges in San Francisco. It brought the entirety of, like, all car traffic to a standstill. I had the genius idea to walk to a party which I won't name because they promised me cotton candy. There was no cotton candy, and I'm still angry a year later.
I respect you sticking to your principles, man. That's important.
Yeah. And they got the start time wrong. So we've been outside for like 45 minutes waiting for this thing to open up.
Really?
Well, it's just raining sideways. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Jesus.
They had two different numbers. It starts at 6 and starts at 7. I don't want to throw shade.
Yeah,
what was super funny is you careen out of a cab going from your AI meet to the riot party, like a random summon from a Yakuza game.
I'm just walking down the street, and the thing is, I've got a backpack, and I'm also carrying like a box full of like camera equipment because our good sponsors of this podcast, Model AI, had given me a camera, and they were like, "Hey, could you record a bunch of stuff while you're at GDC and vlog it, and also send stuff to us?" And I'm like, "Sure." So I'm carrying all this stuff around, and I'm like, "It's raining sideways. I'm miserable. I've got my, you know, hood up or whatever. I've just got my head down, and I'm walking, and I see all these people like hiding under this canopy, like trying not to get soaked." And then I hear this person at the front just regaling and telling tales and trying to like maintain a bit of energy. And I swear, I think I must have got about 10 feet past you. And my brain went, "That's fucking Will." And then I thought, do I go back?
To the other side of it.
Right.
To keep everybody entertained in the fucking wet and the cold, I was telling stories of yesteryore. And suddenly I realized I've developed a crowd. So I don't know what it was, but one part of my brain switches into stand-up comic mode. And so I'm just riffing. You know, I'm making jokes about how Embracer Group had just house-flipped Tomb Raider and stuff like that. It's the only crowd that I could ever make game dev stand-up jokes at. And, yeah, you trundle past. I was like, hey! After you, like, careened off to the riot party, one of the people in the crowd was amazed. Like, how do you know Tommy? How do you know them? Together like 1,000 years ago when I was at CA, right? And they're like, oh, do you follow the AI in game stuff? I'm like,
what are you talking about?
Oh yeah, no, Tommy does all this stuff. I'm like, what? I looked it up after GDC, and I'm just like, it was like finding out Big Matt as a hugely successful podcast, YouTube channel as well. I'm like, Scar Studios, Matt. He's
that guy.
Googling stuff. That guy.
Well, funny enough, I was hanging out with Matt a couple of days later while I was there, because he had a YouTuber event that was hanging out in the gardens, and he's like, do you want to go to it? I was like, absolutely not. That sounds like the worst thing in the world. Because to this day, even though I've been doing this now for 10 years, I still am like, YouTuber? No, I'd rather die in a corner than admit that that's what I am. Even though I've been doing this for so long that I have now to explain myself to a lot of people that I meet. Yes, most people know me as a YouTuber, but also here's the serious things that I do as well. But yeah, so that was the funny thing, because I saw you and I was like, oh, that was amazing. That was so cool. And then I bumped into you, I think, in the expo floor the following day, and we ended up having a proper catch up. And then the following week, I caught your stream where you were like, I bumped into this guy that I met in London like 10 years ago. And apparently he's doing some YouTube thing or something. And people were like, what? So one, I thought that's really, actually, I was really humbled, because I think that's the first time I've ever heard a story where someone else was spoken to, and they're like, you know that guy? And I'm like, because usually most people are just like, oh yeah, you know. And the AI, so funnily enough, because I spent the first 2 days of GDC at the AI summit, and people largely go, oh, that's that YouTube guy. And most of them know who I am because they listen to the videos. And if they don't, why not? I do this for you. But yeah, like people come over and they're like, oh hey Tommy, nice to meet you. And also most of them are like people that have been in the industry for a few years. So they've got their shit together. They're generally composed. I did have one person like properly freak out on me on the expo floor. Like, oh my God, it's you. And I'm like,
Look, the UK games industry does not prepare you for people recognizing you. Like, forgive the term, because it's just what I learned. But working in the UK games industry, you are subject to what's called the circle of abuse. Which isn't as bad as it sounds, but it basically means that everybody rips the piss out of each other. No one has an ego on them because, you know, they'll call you a bastard if you're being a bastard. but it does not prepare you for people like spotting you and being like, oh my God, you're that guy. I'm like, no, whatever you've heard about me is a lie. I promise. It's like, no, I was never
officer,
there.
Honest. I'm an innocent man. And yeah,
sorry, I'm derailing us heavily.
No, like, but I think that actually kind of speaks to both of our kind of like attitudes or approaches towards this sort of thing. Because it is, you meet people and you're like, all right, mate, calm down. So on that note, I think the day later, I'm hanging out with Matt Gamble from the Game Dev Guide YouTube channel.
Mm-hmm.
As most Matt. People know him now. Or Big Matt, right. As we'll call him, from Ska Studios. Well, he's not at Ska. He doesn't do that anymore, but still making games, still working hard. We're hanging out, and I hadn't seen him since he left the UK. And so we're just, how you doing? Blah, blah, blah. What's going on? And people are occasionally like, oh, hey, that's the guy from Game Dev Guide. That's the guy from AI and Games. And we're like, oh, hey, how you doing? Like, go away. We're having a conversation. We bumped into Mark Brown from Game Maker's Toolkit. And this is just like, imagine what we just experienced, but like 20 times worse. Because so Mark and I have never met in person until that day. We'd spoken online a whole bunch of times and, you know, generally a nice guy. And then he turns up and he was still a nice guy. It's not like things changed when he was in person. Like, oh God, YouTube has gone to his head. No, he's a really nice dude. So we're having a chat and we create a fire hazard in the middle of the expo floor.
Yep.
And I'm like,
that's actually what it's referred to in PAX. When a person's internet fame reaches a certain level, they are designated as a fire hazard, and they will have a handler to move them around, because otherwise the critical mass of people trying to get in on the conversation will block pathways.
Right. We actually blocked the alt dev control area by accident. And I'm like, this is really not cool. So we knew we were going to meet up later on that day for the thing, for the YouTube meetup. And I said, let's go. I said, but before we go, I says, we should agree where we're meeting, because I want to agree on a hand signal of some sort. I said, because clearly this crowd that we've generated, about 90% of it's for Mark. And I'm like, let's just agree on some sort of hand signal. So when we're out there in the park, if you're just feeling a bit overwhelmed, just give us a wave and we'll come over and diffuse the situation. Which, on one hand, enough people don't know who I am, which actually kind of works in my favour, is I can just get overtly Scottish and just be like, oh, give a man some space, leave him alone, get the fuck. And then, and of course, it being in America, people either go, oh my God, sir, I'm so sorry, or, where are you from? I'm like, oh, that'll just make me more angry.
Whereabouts in Australia are you from?
Yeah, it's always whereabouts. So actually, I get Ireland and my partner gets Australia.
And yeah,
it's like, whereabouts in Australia you from? Like, what? No, Scotland, you fanny. But anyway,
as a quick tip, if you are from the United States, don't guess the accent. It's ask where someone is from. That's always great. Don't guess, because you're always wrong.
Yeah, almost exclusively 100% of the time wrong. But so I actually realized we haven't really explained what it is you do.
Yeah, no, I guess I'm a bit of an anomaly. So
we're all anomalies if we haven't here met, on the Branching Factor podcast.
that's fair. I think being in game dev is kind of like D&D in that once you reach a certain point, you start multi-classing and shit gets weird. So if we haven't met, hello, my name's Will. I was game dev side for about 10 years, and I do still work with game dev teams, but due to a series of hilarious misfortunes, I fell into streaming full-time. So that's what I do 5 days a week. I do a show on Twitch. I try and feature, you know, weird indie games, but, you know, the bangers do slip in. I'm not immune to an Elden Ring once a week. But I spend my days just, like, talking about the actual realities of how games get made, from biz dev to engine choices to just how the funding cycle will affect games, you know, pretty much anything that isn't directly, you know, programming or asset implementation. And that's what I fell into. I'm a weird one in that I'm not really a personality in the same way a lot of Twitch people are, but by which I mean, like, I'm not a known character. I wasn't famous before I started doing a Twitch thing. And I was certainly infamous in the industry for a few stupid reasons, but I was never famous. So somehow, thanks to my lovely little lot, they've just been keeping me alive for the last 5 years. So yeah, that's what I do on the week. I do consultancy stuff for indie game companies, predominantly like low cost, no cost, because most of the time, the people I talk to, what they need is just like, here's what you need to do to get the business side of stuff set up ahead of time. Here's how you build a community without panicking in the last 2 weeks. Here's when you get your Steam page going. Like, I kind of feel like, I don't know, substitute teacher for a lot of indie projects. And I like that. But I have been working with some teams more long term. I'm currently working on a game called Cosmic Crowbar by Dracogen Studios. Which is a family-friendly game. And I've never done a family-friendly title before. It's lovely.
So, and this was one of the things that I was like, all right, this is definitely interesting to me, definitely bring you on the podcast. But also, one of the things I've always found really interesting is that you're one of the few streamers I can actually think of who has that lick of industry on them. They have that industry stench that they went through cycle. You've been in when we met, like the very first time would have been close to 10 years ago, actually, I think, was during the PR for Total War Warhammer, I want to say.
Yes.
Creative Assembly.
Because Joey was the one in our team working on that one, in the community team, but I was just about. Rome and Attila were the ones I were on.
I think that was it. We were just literally at an event, and a friend, we had a mutual friend who was like, beer? And we're like, yes. And that was it, more or less.
Yeah.
But there's only yourself, and the only other person I can think of off the top of my head is Miles Tost. Tost Spender, as he goes by on Twitch. He's a level designer at CD Projekt Red. Who does level design live stream deconstructions and kind of like talks about level design on Twitch and stuff. And I also bumped into him at GDC last year. And that was great because that was someone I'd known for many years virtually. And we'd got to finally be in the same place. And it was, oh, this is so cool to meet you. And we just bumped into each other at a party. Like, it's you. But also for yourself, like I saw the kind of the rise of your indie profile and actually becoming like a full-time streamer and stuff. A few years ago, and I'm like, I remember that guy. What the fuck has he been up to? And turns out he's doing this thing. Also, a shout out to my Discord community, because a couple of months ago, I think it was like right before GDC, your name had somehow came up in conversation.
Oh, it wasn't about the jowling, rowling, cowling nonsense.
I can't recall off the top of my head, but someone was just like, this guy, he's on Twitch and what have you, like Will something or other. And I'm like, and they look and like they put the URL and I'm like, Will Overgard. I know that guy.
This time last year, I was under siege by the internet to the point where the Daily Mail called me US gamer Will Overgard, which I'm still mad about.
I did not
know games industry professional or streamer, US gamer.
Oh, you were in the Daily Mail. What?
Yeah. I told people, I was trying to explain to the American audience how Joanne has an effect on like things happening in the UK, and how that if you choose as a streamer to support products that she is tied to, that you might be aligning yourself with some very bad people.
Okay.
And a bad time about that. Sorry, I don't mean to wibbly wobbly about it. I don't want to derail us too far.
Oh, no, that's fine. But also, like, I totally get it if you don't want to go back into it. I mean, if I had the Daily Mail knocking on my door, I wouldn't want to talk about it again.
But yeah, so jumping back, there are loads of game dev people that do stream. I think a few people got the bug during lockdown. And I'm just going to reference this because it's my favorite. The best one being Rami, who during a stream of Flight Simulator locked himself out of his apartment while the plane was careening, creating a situation where he had to break into his own house before the plane crashed. Still love that.
I did do, what was it? I got Rami on for an interview to discuss Earth Defense Force. Because he's probably the other most high-profile person I could think of that loves Earth Defense Force. And I still get comments on that YouTube video to this day where people just go, oh man, it's so nice to hear people that like Earth Defense Force. Our work here on the Branching Factor podcast is made possible thanks to the good folks who support us on Patreon. As you might know, me, Tommy, the host here of the Branching Factor podcast, I run the AI in Games YouTube channel. I talk about how artificial intelligence works in video games and how AI research is empowered by the use of games. And AI in Games has been supported by our Patreon community for several years now. And it's thanks to them that we receive sponsorship that helps me and the team do more, including spending time with my friends right here on the Branching Factor podcast. Supporters on Patreon get access to a whole bunch of content for the Branching Factor podcast. You get to listen to episodes ad-free and even get to listen to them early before they go live to the wider world. Plus, you could submit questions to the team here on our Discord server, have your name read out in our producer credits, and even get bonus content that doesn't get published elsewhere. To find out how to join, head on over to patreon.com/AIingames. That's Patreon, patreon.com/AIingames. And a special thanks to all of our patrons for their continued support of everything we're doing right here on Branching Factor. One of my favorite comments on this video is also the most depressing, is someone said, I wish I could find a video game that I could love like you two love Earth Defense Force. And I was like, that speaks a lot to how you consume content and how you think about content. Like, well, one, don't call it content.
Don't call it a content. It's been here for years. If that person is somehow out there, come hit me up. One of my specialty skills I'm very proud of is I love playing video game sommelier for people. There is a game out there for them. I can find it.
Right. I can't remember who it was that wrote the comment, but hunt well down.
But jumping back. What's interesting is that there are game devs who stream, and there are streamers who have moved into game dev, but I haven't found anybody else who was game dev and is now making their living on Twitch.
Right.
I haven't found anybody else, which it's very isolating sometimes, so it's lovely to have these kind of chats.
I mean, let's face it, there's not that many artificial intelligence and games academic researchers who then decided to become content creators and then consultants in the video games industry. So yes, we're both in a very small crowd over here, but we can be in our separate crowds together. How did you get from A to B, I guess? Because as you said, you sort of have even just what the things you were talking about there, like a lot of the stuff that you're doing for smaller indies, this is all stuff that, you know, even myself, when I did the indie thing, I would have killed to have got that knowledge. Like, what was the tipping point where you just went, oh, you know what, this seems like a thing to throw myself behind? Because also, I imagine it's not an easy thing to go from like a steady paycheck at a studio or whatever else to then saying, this is the thing I'm going to do, and I'm going to kind of rely on the will of the crowd even to kind of like keep me aloft.
It's not something that I would have sat down and done a business plan for. The knowledge acquisition was, after leaving CA, I worked in a bunch of very strange environments, and I did a lot of different things, usually predominantly around like indies and small teams. From like trying to raise funding to getting publishing deals to all sorts. I was self-described, this wasn't my title, but I was a bounty hunter for a while during the golden age of indie publishing money. I would go out, find indie teams, bring them to an indie publisher, and they'd give me like a finder's fee.
Gotcha.
So I got real good at like translating first-time indie speak into biz dev speak. There was also a time where I had to take a bunch of military guys around a PAX. I'll have to tell you about that another time.
What the hell?
So, you know what? It's been over 5 years. So, I worked for Rocketworks down in New Zealand. Had a great time. Like, shout out to Dean and the crew. Real good to me. But had some family stuff kind of go awry. And when you're the only PR marketing community guy on a semi-independent team, you can't be off your game for 2-3 months, right? So no. I resigned from Rocketworks, moved back to the UK. I got offered a job working with some friends, and that put me out here in Seattle. That whole thing imploded so badly.
Yes.
And I was suddenly at a point where I didn't have a place to stay. I didn't have anything going on. I just moved out to Seattle with a bag and a promise. And I was like, oh, shit. But that previous role had been running a Twitch channel with an audience that had, like, real good games literacy. If I'm not mentioning them, it's because I don't want to give them any fucking credit. I don't want to give them any fucking coverage.
I'm not saying it. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I'm sure people can find it if they really want to.
Yup. It's old drama. It's an old mess. But it led me to streaming solo because we've been doing a run of Hollow Knight on that space. And I got people being like, hey, are you going to keep doing this? I was like, fuck it, why not? I got bullied by some friends who were like, you need to be streaming on this day at this time. We're going to raid you. You've got to do it. No choice. So I was staying on my mate's sofa. He let me use his rig during the day. And that was the path, you know? I stayed with him while I was getting some tax stuff sorted. And then after that all got sorted, the Twitch thing had enough momentum that I was like, fuck it, let's risk it for a biscuit. And it's been... yeah, it'll be 6 years next month that I've been predominantly independently Twitch.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, Phil, absolutely hats off to you because, like, you know, the way that I work is so, like, we were just talking about this offline. Like, my YouTube channel just turned 10 years old last week.
Yay!
There is no way in hell I could do that full time. Like, the YouTube does not make enough money at all. Like, my YouTube maybe makes like, hang on, let me do the math in my head, like $400 a month. If I have a good video, a big video that turns into a bit of a banger, I might have $600-$700 a month. You can't live off that. So like my entire business model is I make videos and put my voice out on the internet and then with the whole idea, and this is so risky, but at the same time, my partner was like, you actually have something here, just do it. Where I go, blah, 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 artificial intelligence and video games. Yeah. Except I don't do it in that voice because, but that's how all my Scottish, that's how all my Scottish friends hear it. So I'm not. So I'll put a new video out. My brother's immediately like, ah, it was really good, but you still sound like a wanker. I'm like, oh, cheers, mate. Love you too.
Edinburgh tang, if you will.
It is. It's like, yes, yes. Glasgow with a slit, with a hint of Edinburgh. But what happens is that I put the videos out and then people go, he seems to know a thing or two about a thing or two with regards to the artificial intelligence in the video game. Maybe we should speak to him and we have money. And then I'm a sucker for money. And so. That's basically it. So like I do all this consultancy work now, which pays for me to have time off to make YouTube content. And then it's a self-perpetuating cycle. And I've been doing that. I've only been doing that full time now for about 18 months and it is actually working.
Yay!
I think. Well, my accountant says it's good. So we'll take it from there.
Like, I don't mind talking about the business side of it. Like, I've often described we call it business model. I'm basically a bartender that doesn't make drinks. Like, I subsist on tips. I'm dead honest with everybody who watches the stream. It's like, you don't have to throw in anything, but if you throw in, like, $2 or $3 or what have you, like, that's going to pay my rent and help me feed the animals and whatnot. I'm just dead honest with it. And here's the flip side. Because Twitch is what pays the rent and lets me eat, that allows me to do this free consultancy stuff with indies, to sit down with them and be like, all right, this is what you got to do. Let's get you on track. I don't have to charge them at that point.
Each other. That's hilarious.
Right? And then sometimes those indies go, oh, actually, we have some budget. Do you want to do a cool thing? I'm like, yeah, I want to do a cool thing. You want to sponsor a stream? You want me to do an asset or something? Like, hells yeah. So it does mean that I don't have to chase people down for cash. And I can be dead honest and be like, look, if you've got budget, I'd quite like to eat, but if you don't, we can still make this work. And that's the best part of what I'm doing.
So actually, I do have a... like, we actually had like an original production document. We're completely ignoring it because this conversation is far more interesting. That's actually an interesting thing because particularly in the last year, interest rates have gone up. Everything's more expensive. Cost of living's turned into a nightmare. How have you found that in the context of how your audience engages and supports you monetarily? Because one of the things I say to my Patreon supporters, patreon.com/AIandGames, is that, look, you support when you can support. If you don't have the money, if you've got to put food on the table, if you've got a family or whatever your personal circumstances are, I'm just an idiot on the internet. If you need that money, you put that money in front of yourself. Because I've had people reach out to me, like DM me on the Discord or the email me through Patreon, and they go, I'm sorry, I have to cancel. I feel really bad about it. I'm like, don't feel bad. Like, you look after yourself. I appreciate you reaching out and us having this conversation. I appreciate that you're thinking of me, but please, I'm the last person to be thinking about. Think about yourself first. And so I've seen probably over the year, like my patronage has dropped about 20, it dipped at one point to about 30% below what it was year on year. It's came back a little bit. Like, what's it been like on Twitch? Is it, I mean, I wouldn't even bother trying to fill that in. Like,
so it's worth noting that I am once again an anomaly in this state. Like, you know, I don't make my money predominantly off of subscriptions. It is on bits and donations, because when it comes to bits, Twitch doesn't charge you anything. It does charging a point of sale for the user. And donations, I mean, that's just PayPal doing PayPal stuff. And again, it's just, I'm dead honest with everybody. I have seen a big old dip because everybody's hurting. And yeah, my audience is predominantly either games industry or people that are games industry enthusiasts or adjacent.
Yeah.
And that's a sphere that's getting hit like a hurricane.
Yes.
So, yeah, no, it's freaking brutal right now. I keep joking that if anyone just stumbles across a giant chest of cursed gold and want to send it my way, I'm going to say no. But in the same time, I'm like, there are a lot of people that do say things like, I'm sorry that I can't chip in. I'm sorry that I've had to cancel my sub, and say, no, you look after yourself first.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Although my running joke is that I just need you to sell a massively successful indie game the next few years, because that's my retirement plan. So look after yourself, get your game out there, and then when you're a squillionaire, then I can mooch off you. You know, like those ornamental gardeners they used to have during the Victorian era?
Right,
the guy would look like a gnome with a big hat. Yeah, just I'm going to be that for somebody else.
Just standing constantly, like battle cry position or something in their garden.
But yeah, it's also why I'm so keen to help as many people as I can without charging, because, and I'm sorry if I'm taking us too far off of the beaten path, but one thing I have noticed is a massive slew of people going into consultancy, which is good, but also people selling some really shiesty, like, courses and webinars and things like that. Again, naming no names because I ain't here to start beef, but one that's been across my Facebook feed is this, you can make $5,000 a month as an indie dev. All you need to do is pay for my course and you'll get all the tools you'll need. I'm like, fuck off.
What?
Right off.
You could make $5,000 a month if you buy this time machine and go back to like 2009.
Yeah.
And start making games for an Android phone. Or something.
Now, there is a methodology for creating a sustainable indie company that's still working. Like, just Strange Scaffold, Sock Pop, there's tons out there. They don't get a lot of coverage because, well, they're succeeding quietly. But it is doable to create a sustainable indie space.
Yeah.
But you're not going to take this. There's no one golden bullet to make thousands of dollars a month as an indie.
I mean,
like it's a fucking setting in Unity.
I mean, I can empathize. I mean, I'm an AI. If there's one space right now that's full of people that are peddling snake oil, good lord.
Oh, mate, I'm AI so
and
sorry.
Video games.
Okay, so obviously we've got to talk about what it's going to be like at GDC, and that is going to involve talking about a lot of these snake oils. I'd like to take a quick second to shout out a very good friend of mine.
Go for it.
Star Saint Germain. And Star Saint Germain ran an AI-supported game on Discord called the Bureau of Multiversal, it's either Arbitration or Affairs, I always get it wrong, where it was a live game, not live service, but live game, where all players were agents for the Bureau of Multiversal Affairs, and it was their job to decide what is and isn't true in the multiverse. And my favorite example is two robots, in desperately in love robots, got hit with an EMP. They've lost all their memories. So it was up to the Bureau to generate one perfect happy memory of them together. And Star had actually created her own adversarial AI throughout lockdown with her own data set and everything that ran all this, and used like a facial mapping software to do live video stuff. And it was fucking brilliant. They had a live event. There was a grand finale where a villain broke into the Multiversal Affairs office and was trying to unmake reality. So the agents were fighting back against it. I wanted to cap this. I wanted to put this before the rest of our conversation, because with the sheer amount of snake oil being sold in the AI space, like, this GDC we're going into is going to be like 2001 GDC, but for, you know, crypto. Right? Because that's the space where everybody has money to advertise, you know. Remember, do you see the Gala Games all over GDC with their play-to-earn stuff? Like, it was going to be the new paradigm in video games.
Oh my goodness. Actually, I need to make a note of this, because I had no idea about this Discord game that had happened, and this sounds super interesting to me, so I need to dig into that as an aside. Like, that's something for me to look into at some point.
I don't know if I'm allowed to recommend you future guests, but have a sit down with Star Saint Germain if you get the chance, because, one, she worked on an award-winning iOS game that no one played called Hollow Vista. Whilst I was fucking about and building Gundams during lockdown, she created her own adversarial AI setup. That was her lockdown hobby.
Yeah, and I didn't get a lockdown hobby, but no, this sounds super interesting. I definitely need to get into this at some point. But yeah, like, this is
I wanted to balance out the positives and the negatives, you know?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that this is, like, coming from the perspective also as one of the organizers of the AI summit at GDC, we're in this very weird space of, for much of the industry, it's business as usual. We are just doing AI the way we have done AI for years. So to give you a little bit of inside baseball, some of the talks we have this year at the AI summit, the AI of Warframe, which is all good old-fashioned game AI. We've got this, like, one talk, which is going to be the evolution of the AI tools used in the Crytek engine. From, like, Crysis all the way to Hunt Showdown. And I'm like, that sounds super interesting to me.
God, I'm glad I'm not going to be able to go see that. That sounds like a great talk.
We've got zombie AI in Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3. We've got navigation in Suicide Squad. Which I'm the mentor to that talk, and it's really good. I just read through the latest draft of it. And the thing I love about this talk is, oh yeah, navigation. Everyone thinks this is a solved problem. No. What else have we got? And then
I'm laughing at the idea of, like, oh, navigation video games? Yeah, we solved that years ago.
Nope.
Yeah. No.
Continue. But yeah, it's like, we could just put a nav mesh on it. No. And then I won't spoil it. It might become a video at some point. I don't know. Like, I was so interested by the talk that they pitched. I'm like, this is a YouTube video already. Because I did a whole video like a year or so ago about Death Stranding, which is just trying to get people to walk in Death Stranding's fucking difficult. And people go, but it's just a game about walking. And then you see all the work they had to do on the AI side. And I'm like, oh God, this looks frustrating. And then on the other side, we've got all this machine learning and deep learning stuff that has been in the industry for a few years. And it's stuff that we've been doing for a while. And we've figured out how it works. And we're figuring out how to put it into pipelines and making it useful and actually yield positive outcomes for games. And then we've got the generative AI stuff. And for every, I think, genuinely interesting, well thought out, well produced piece of work that's coming out of that's generative AI based, we've just got a lot of stuff that's being peddled. And from the even from the outside looking in, I'm like, that's shite. Like, no one's going to use this. Just to derail us slightly, I just came back from a trip. I've just been overseas for this week. At a game studio as consulting on AI stuff. And one of the things they really want to do is they really want to use a lot of generative AI. And we were having a lot of conversations about this. And one of the consistent threads that we pulled out was, we're really interested in using it for ideation and iteration. So just getting things off the ground when you're just like, I need something in the game to get me moving. And then we can polish it up because we've got something that's basic and something that works. And the other thing that cropped up was, most of the tools that are out there don't really do what we need. Because we've got this, I think we're in the first phase of generative AI stuff, where a lot of companies got a lot of money and went, games, that's the place that we can make money, games. And it's like, did you get a single game developer to consult on this thing that you built? Like, we engage with the community. Like, so that's a no. So you got all these tools.
Sorry, I always love that phrase of, we're engaging with the community. The fuck you are.
So you end up with
you
all this stuff.
You don't even know who you're talking to, do you?
It's like, yeah, this is cool, but I can't use this like that in a production environment. I can't use this the way that you're pitching it and still have my game on Steam.
What's been really fascinating is, I mean, I'm sure you've seen the same thing. A lot of the old Web3 squad have just pivoted. A lot of them believe that generative AI is the connective tissue that they didn't have before, completely ignoring developer habits and user habits. And that's going to be a lot of what we're going to have to suffer through at GDC.
Oh, I swear. I sorry to just briefly derail you. Like, in my presentation...
No, mate, this is your house.
Yeah, but you're my guest. When I now do introductions, so I've already got like 4 or 5 events I'm talking at in the next 2 months. I now have a slide which has a joke in it about, here's my career and resume. It's not like my LinkedIn said NFT evangelist last year and I scrubbed it out and then put in AI evangelist. And I actually have a mocked up fake version of my LinkedIn, which has like a picture of a monkey on it. And then it's like, you know, NFT evangelist underneath my name. And then it's like what it looks like now. And it's like, no. Like, I've been in this space for like almost 20 years. It's not like, actually, that is depressing. I've been in this space for almost 20 years back when I was in grad school studying AI.
That's awesome.
It is, but also it's like, oh, that's cool. And then also, oh my God, the passage of time. Hey all, Tommy here with a quick plug for an additional way you can support and engage with Branching Factor and everything happening at AI in games. Our new website is hosted over on Substack, the popular newsletter website. You can catch up with every episode of AI in games, including written versions of every video. Plus, each episode of Branching Factor is also available for you to listen there as well. By signing up with a free subscription, you guarantee that every update on everything I'm working on is sent directly to you, and you don't have to manage different apps or social media platforms to keep in the loop. Plus, you can also support AI in Games as a paid subscriber on Substack from as little as $5 a month. And with that, you get access to additional bonus content, including ad-free episodes of Branching Factor, our monthly newsletter, and recordings from community meetings as we discuss future content coming down the pipeline. To subscribe, head on over to aiingames.com to find out even more, or search for AI in Games on your Substack reader.
I've seen empires rise and fall. I was there when the old words were written.
I remember when EA's Project $10 was a thing. People go, what?
Don't get me started. Project $10 is my Roman Empire. It's my Roman fucking empire. I'm not even joking. I could dominate the rest of this conversation with that. But anyway, jumping back.
But yes, I feel certainly it was like, even last year, I noticed like people were telling me the Web3 part of the GDC Expo floor had got smaller.
There were a few shiesty ones. There was the people that were trying to sell NFTs of parts of the world. And the thing was, I didn't take the cursed gold the first year round, and I do actually regret that. But sorry. Okay. 2022. There was a gigantic NFT booth, and in the center of it was just a table littered with these gorgeous like little openable cases, and in each one was a physical representation of their cryptocurrency in this faux gold. And I realized that was cursed. Like, maybe it steals your money when you grab it, maybe they stalk you with a fucking, I don't know, geotag or what have you. Or perhaps it's like Pirates of the Caribbean, you grab it and then your hand turns to skeleton. But I've been obsessed with it ever since, and I regret not taking it. And that's how cursed gold gets you. But I guess for your lovely listeners as well, right after lockdown, the GDCs were predominantly like dominated by NFT, crypto, and play-to-earn companies who were selling absolutely nothing. Obviously, that bottomed out because there was never a product. There was never something that was going to be implemented or implementable. Ironically, the blockchain revolution in games happened probably back in like 2016, 2017, and all the concepts were just too expensive to run. So they ended up like keeling over. There was a brilliant one that was a CCG, where it was based on, you'll have to forgive me, this is just a layman's explanation, but using blockchain stuff, each card was unique. And the idea was not only would you buy packs, but you could lend them to people when you weren't using them. So it was a free-to-play game where the cards that the free-to-play users were using was just somebody else's in the world when they weren't online. And the idea is you'd be able to use these cards in multiple kinds of games. Obviously, their flagship product was a Magic the Gathering clone, but there was going to be like a dungeon crawler and stuff like that. But the problem was, to make any changes to it was such a massive undertaking. And any cards implemented... Sorry, that's my puppy. I know, I'm talking about crypto. I'm so sorry. anything rolled out in that system was nigh on impossible to roll back without wiping out everything.
You couldn't balance it?
No.
Or rebalance it?
You could make changes inside the individual titles, but like you couldn't take cards away from a user.
Right.
And just the sheer amount of dev hours required to maintain it was too much, and the project died on the vine, you know? And that's how most of them did. Anyway, I guess I'm just reminiscing.
Funnily enough, you're kind of speaking to where I think a lot of the AI stuff's going to go, because a lot of these, the big difference is, one, there is a lot of interesting stuff that is actually, this is always the argument I make, the big difference between Web3 and generative AI is there's actually some good stuff here.
Yes.
But there's also a lot of legally infringing and dodgy stuff and stuff that isn't that cool. But critically, it's all super expensive because they've all these companies have got to have a lot of infrastructure, and it costs a lot of money to maintain that infrastructure. And so...
Well, I won't bore your lovely audience with, as they probably well know, is that Web3 was predominantly based on the idea that users wanted more of a complicated shopping and interactive experience, which they don't. Users don't want to have to log into Second Life to buy something on Amazon. Amazon already exists. You know, we don't want an additional heavily complex layer between them and their games. They want to just play the games. You know, and I am seeing that a lot of those people are shifting towards the generative AI space, the people who are peddling Web3. And I don't know. Sorry, I don't mean to keep bringing it back around a circle. It's just the problem that I imagine that you're facing in your space is that the most visible and public parts of that technology are the worst parts of it.
Yes, I think absolutely. Without a doubt. And... you know, I try to be an advocate for the stuff that I think is good and the stuff that I think is interesting. I remember even last year I did a couple of sponsored videos on my channel where I actually worked with a couple of generative AI companies, and I got a bit of heat for that. And it's like, well, no, I did my due diligence on this. I didn't just agree to do it willy-nilly. And I did it on the basis that I want to know how their tech actually works and what they're doing to address real. You know, if people have watched those videos, particularly the videos with InWorld and Convey, go and check them out. Because I interviewed people at their company and I'm asking them, like, how do you solve this problem? And how do you solve that problem? Because this stuff's all well and good. And I genuinely think both of those technologies was interesting. I don't think either of them was ready yet to put in a... Well, actually, I think we're still years away from most games putting that in a shippable product because legal ambiguities, or rather just the space is too risky right now, I think, for a lot of companies to take it on. But two, the tools are still evolving and they've not reached a point where you can like say, I'm going to be able to ship this game and be confident with it because you're going to put it in the tool chain. And then like, I've still got 3 years of development. Hopefully this company's still standing by the time I'm finished. So
yeah,
I think that's it. And I think it's kind of critical to point out that, like we say, because a lot of these, and I agree with you, a lot of these people have pivoted from Web3 into AI, it is drowning out a lot of the genuinely interesting, innovative work that is happening in the space. Just, this is also me putting this out there in case anyone's sitting there going, hang on, is the AI guy just being negative about AI all the time? I mean, yes, I am, but I usually just keep that offline and not on the microphone.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're the person whose videos I've been referring to when getting knowledge on this one. And I know this is a hyperbole example, but the upscaling of the Mass Effect Remastered was fucking brilliant. Like, those kinds of tools, the behind-the-scenes weird shit that we've been using in games for a gajillion years, it fits so nicely into that. But, and I know this is a bit hyperbole as well, but things like the Wonka experience up in Glasgow, and that's what, like, that's what people outside the programming and the AI, the actual meat and potatoes, that's what they're seeing. You know, they're seeing these horrible, twisted images. And the thing I'm seeing in the indie space is that when it comes to generative AI art, oh boy, do not get caught using generative AI art, because you will have a user base turn on you like that.
Right. So I think this is a good way to turn it over back to yourself a little bit, because there is, I think, for all of the legitimate uses that are plausible with use of generative AI, I think by virtue of a lot of the stuff that's being peddled out there, it has now created, I think, a scenario where actually, and I've literally heard spoken to companies who are actually thinking this, it is not worth us doing this. And at any beyond basic ideation and iteration, once we get onto a point where we need a production level asset, we take that as our blueprint, and then a real artist actually goes and does the work. Because they're also just saying, one, we don't want to put it out there because they're worried about lot check on PlayStation, Xbox, Nintendo. Like, am I going to get a game onto the Switch or the Switch 2 because I've got generated textures in there? But more critically, the backlash that has started to emerge, often, I think, rightly justified in gaming circles as well. In the same way that gaming, like, I think the gaming community amazingly pushed back very well against Web3. It seems like now we're seeing the same thing with AI. And, like, I wonder what's the perspective from yourself on this, because I do think we're in this weird space of stuff is rightfully being called out, but also I now worry about the genuinely interesting stuff that's now going to struggle to get any sort of level of credibility.
This week has had an excellent case study. So, just touching on what you said a little bit, so the NFT thing was definitely wailed upon because there was no follow-through for users. Users could see that it was snake oil and that it was basically scamming their parents. With generative art in AI, users feel that their art is being taken and used without their permission. Even if those individuals aren't artists and they aren't prolific artists, they feel that it is being taken. What was fascinating this week was, your podcast listeners won't be able to see this. I'm a huge Rainworld fan. I actually have a Rainworld tattoo on my arm of the original 3 Slugcats. So I am obsessed with that game.
Don't worry, there is a video version of this podcast, so they will see it.
Oh, cool! Oh, no, which means everybody saw the dog and my face changing colours. Sorry.
That's fine. People love dogs.
If I'm backlit, it's because I'm looking at what was our running order. But anyway,
your side of the screen is way more interesting than my side of the screen, so we're all good.
I've got shields, I've got Gundams, I've got a skeleton.
They've seen all my stuff before. They know what this looks like. Yeah. It's all good.
That is Lord Calcium Bonio. He is my co-conspirator. Anyway, Rainworld announced earlier this week, it might have been last week, but within the last, like, 7 days or so, that during Rainworld Art Month, which they do every year, where all the fan base draw slug cats doing adventures and they set a challenge every day, that they were going to be doing this year, and they were partnering with this one company. I won't name them because I don't want to start shit again. Wow, I'm being really polite today. The TLDR is they were a generative AI company, and they would take clips that came out of your game and allow people to then continue playing the game from that save state point, which they claimed they did using generative AI. Now, that's clearly a sprinkling of sales nonsense over some kind of tech startup. But the user backlash was so vitriolic. Like, and thing was, it wasn't a big announcement. It was the second tweet after the initial post. So they had to lock down the entirety of the Rainworld Discord and socials. And the company they announced just got rid of their Discord links and just got into hiding. Like, the user response was so, so vitriolic.
I genuinely heard something on, I think, Blue Sky. Like, a couple of days ago, someone was talking about the Rainworld drama, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. Like, I went away, dug into it, I had to get into the weeds.
So basically, the new publishers of Rainworld, because they got away from Adult Swim, thank fuck. That's the drama from today, but... The publisher even went that, like, look, we are listening to our community. Obviously, Rainworld's a successful game based on its community, so they do have to respond if they want to stay afloat. And they will not be using this product. They were going to partner with them. That partnership is now dead because it wouldn't have survived. And with a lot of these things, user response is an important part of it. When we're on the game dev side, we can forget that user perception is incredibly important.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned Project $10. Project $10 was actually really fucking smart because it was a battle against the pre-owned market that was predominant throughout the 2000s. And the idea of being like, oh, we're going to give users $10 of free DLC if they buy the game new. If they buy it secondhand, that's going to cost them $10. And users were like, you're fucking charging us for secondhand games? EA's like, wait, no, that's not what we meant at all. But that was the user perception. Project $10 died on how it was perceived. You can see what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It was games companies trying to not get gouged by, you know, Game and GameStop and things like that. Oh, how the turntables have turned there. I was going to
say, it's funny how those things have turned out, huh?
Yeah, but that's not how users perceived it. And in this case, user perception is going to be massive. So I do think that a lot of the public generative art AI usage is going to be crucified, for lack of a better term.
Oh, my light's turned off because they're on a timer. And it's that time of night. So we're recording this late because we're finishing up an episode of The Branching Factor, and then we're immediately going to jump over to Will's Twitch, and we're going to be hanging out there as well. So,
We're going to be sailing the seven seas, my friend.
I had to reinstall Sea of Thieves, man. I haven't played it in like a good year, and I was like, oh my god, I don't actually have it installed. What the hell? but yeah, like definitely, you're kind of right now. It seems like again, this was a conversation I literally had a couple of days ago, that we're in this space where the problem is it's a chicken and egg problem that is self-perpetuating and is not going to stop. Because right now, in order for anyone to really start taking generative AI seriously, we need to start seeing games that have gone all in on it and shown interesting new gameplay opportunities that people are actually excited about.
Yeah. But
studios are genuinely, because of the legal situation, because of the public perception, but also because these tools are often not mature enough yet to really put in a production life cycle. Also because AAA games take like 5 years to make.
Yeah.
And so people are going, hang on, why is this generative AI tool that's been out 2 weeks not being used in your new fancy, you know, $300 million game? They're like, because we started development on it 4 years ago. We don't have, like, putting this tool into our game now is suicide. Like,
yes.
So we're in this space now where all the stuff that's coming out, we're not seeing anything rich enough as a case study to highlight the actual potentially interesting use cases that it could be applied to. So whereas, funnily enough, I think you mentioned the texture upscaling from Mass Effect. Like, I was interviewed about this a while ago, and I referred to it as, this was a silent revolution. A whole bunch of this stuff happened in games for years, and the general purpose player did not know.
Nor would they need to.
No.
Like, you know, they don't need to know what fucking project management software I'm using. They don't need to know, like, which fucking Test Track Pro variation I have. You know, they wouldn't need to know that.
They don't need to. They'll find out. They watch my videos. But yeah, like even things like, you know, using deep learning for animation. All right, we started doing that almost 10 years ago. Actually, we did. Actually, the first example of what became AI-powered animation was in Hitman Absolution. And that was like over a decade ago now. But like...
Only good things come out of that game.
And then they put it all into Hitman 2016.
New Hitman's doing great.
Anyway,
we can snark about it. We're allowed to snark about it. New Hitman is very good.
Absolution is not great, but the World of Assassination is... Mm.
They put Sean Bean back in as well. So you'll be able to kill him in like 20 days again. Yeah, he's back.
Oh my God, I need to...
Undying.
I need to finish playing Evil Within on stream just so I can go and kill Sean Bean on loop. Or try to kill Sean Bean on loop. Just constantly buying fresh copies on new accounts.
I got him once, but it was like... I killed us both at the same time, so I don't know if I count that. I misjudged how much they used in way of explosives. It was supposed to just go and take him out. I wiped out half a building, myself included, so...
Mm. I mean, at least you got him, you know.
Yeah.
Sean Bean is dead. So, yeah, I think that's the problem. It's just there's too many... We're not seeing enough stuff that's actually cool coming out that is then going to further drive that enthusiasm and innovation. And I think also critically, like, because of the... Like, right now, the law is not fully formed, and there's too many of these tools that use data sets that are probably stolen and are... Well, those companies are being sued by multiple people right now. And so it's like, if they're using that data, you really shouldn't be using those tools in your games right now, because that's also going to cause you all sorts of headaches.
Yes.
And so
one thing that's been mentioned off of actually a lot of like John Oliver's stuff is how generative AI stuff might get smacked around in the US because it's an easy soft target for political policies.
Right.
Like, no one has a war chest to defend it. The companies that are using it are like OpenAI, which is a loose conglomerate of different money peoples. And if that shit gets wobbly enough, they'll all step away. So with things like automated calls and AI art scams and things like that, there's a potential that American policymakers could use it as a soft target to be like, oh, look at us. Standing up for your rights and just start wailing on it. That's out of my wheel well. Like, world affairs are beyond my noggin, but that's always an alarm bell.
I'll wait for George to get back, because George, whenever I have to start talking about legal ramifications within the games industry, I'm like, all right, George, it's time for you to shine, buddy. You got
to
do
it. Time to come on down.
There's some people might find it a bit dry, but it's the thing that you do very well.
I'll tell you what, let me drop another positive block in here.
I was going to say, right?
Because
that's good, because I was about to pivot to a negative thing. So
one of the things that I saw during like 2016, 2017 was VR is the future. The people that would then go on to be the scummers selling Web3 and the people that are now peddling snake oil in a generative sense, like, they were pushing VR as the new paradigm. We were all going to get headsets. We were all going to switch to virtual reality. That's it. Regular games, fucking dead. VR, that's the future. I've tasted it. And yes, I do the Phoenix Knight voice every time. It's the future. I've tasted it. It's chicken Kievs. But these peddlers, they were selling VR in every facet of everything. Like, industry, medicine, tech, video games, the whole shebang. That didn't happen. Now, I'm still mad because those shiesty buggers ended up killing a lot of really interesting companies, game studios, and a lot of interesting projects, because they convinced these people to put all in on VR. And then these games came out. They were great experiences. They sold like 4 copies because, you know, the amount of hardware and financial resources required to have a good VR setup is massive. All right. But the reason why this is a positive is that the VR space has continued, right? We're still seeing slow iterations. There's some really great games in that space.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a hobbyist niche, but it still exists. And I think a lot of the stuff that you'd interact with, the stuff that is actually doing good, making an impact, helping make games better, like, that stuff is going to survive this. But, God, it's going to be a messy year of change, let me tell you.
Yeah. So speaking of the other mess, I guess, that's happening, particularly around GDC, is... I imagine the expo floor is going to be a hell of a lot busier this year because, well, 15,000 people have lost their job in the last year and change. People are going to be looking for work.
Yep.
And I guess
I'm still pissed. Sorry, just as an aside, I'm still pissed they're charging 300 a head to get on the expo floor.
Are
because
they?
Like, yeah, though, unless you pre-bought your ticket, the base ticket, like if one of your viewers suddenly goes, I'm going to GDC, that's $300, mate. And that's just for the expo floor, not for any of the things you're involved in, not for the talks.
No,
if
no,
you
want
to go see a studio and talk to a recruiter, that's 300 quid in. Like, fuck off. This is the year to go like, you know what? Expo show floor, so long as you can prove your industry credentials, just come on in.
One, there was one event that I think it might be in the UK. I think it might be WASD that's coming up in the UK has actually said they're giving away free passes to people who are like job hunting or whatever. Don't know if it was WASD, don't quote me on that, but I know at least one other event came out recently and said, no, if you're in the industry, if you're looking for work, free pass, like come and meet people. And like, I guess from your end, like, because like you said, you interact with a lot of indies as well. Like, what's that space been like? Because I just, this is
I
the
can
thing
sum
I've been
up that question.
About.
I can sum up that question very neatly is that one of the few events that I am guaranteed going to at GDC is the, was it, it's like Scream to Match. Oh, God darn it. I've got it in my calendar at noon. At noon on Wednesday, all the indies are going to the gardens to just scream. That's it. We're just screaming at noon.
Oh my God.
So yeah, for those of you who haven't been to a lot of GDCs, the Unabuena Park is usually this meeting of the indies, right? People can't afford, or people that just hang in with friends. Some people will host like unofficial micro talks and stuff like that. It's real cool. The gardens are going to be jumping this year because the amount of jobs available in the industry right now versus the amount of people looking for it, like, it's a crapshoot.
Yeah.
So better to shore up with friends, better to club together as indies rather than try and, like, blow $300 you don't have and, you know, roll the dice that maybe your portfolio is just exactly what somebody is looking for in some large, maybe sustainable company. Right.
And
so that's what a lot of it's going to be looking like.
There are jobs, but there's not that many. And like you say, people are looking for very specific skill sets at this point. And also they have the luxury of being to discriminate more. I use the term discriminate, not in a in the sense that you might think, but just generally in the sense that, like, I have 8 times the number of normal applications for this job. I can spend more time finding the one that I really want.
The team on, I believe it was Whisker Squadron, which is a great game and worth checking out. They put out an open call earlier in the year for somebody to work on their team. And they got 300 applications within the first few hours. And
good Lord.
People with 10 years experience who have shipped gigantic titles applying for what is essentially a small but stable indie team. Mm-hmm. Because it's a buyer's market, you know, and the big studios do know this. They are very aware that it is a buyer's market right now. But I know the mantra at the moment in the like Indian small studio space is just survive till 25. Like, do what you got to do, survive till 25.
Because even the financing for a lot, I mean, even last year, actually. So I finished GDC last year and immediately, because I was working for a small studio in London. And then immediately went to the London finance market at WASD. And WASD is like the new EGX Resd.
Same team that did EGX Resd, just rebrand.
Yeah, because Resd is now dead.
Rest in peace.
Yeah, like even then when we were pitching, it was like, okay, well, this looks okay, but we've run out of budget for this year.
So I had this weird thing.
We ran out of budget for this fiscal year and next fiscal year. What are you doing? What are you looking like in 2025, 2026? We're like, mate, we're just trying to keep the lights on.
So one of the things that I encountered, which was the first alarm bells for me, is, as I said, like, I used to be in that weird little intersection of introducing people, right?
Yeah.
So I would often go to, like, publishers and financing people and be like, hey, I know these people. They're doing some really cool shit. Get them on your docket. And again, I wasn't doing this for a cut. Like, I wasn't a consultant. I wasn't working on commission. But it was just I'd been in that space. And so 2022. Um,
quick break to all the banter to take a moment to thank our patrons who support us here on the Branching Factor podcast. Without that support, we wouldn't have kicked off this fun new venture for all of us to take part in. Don't forget that by supporting us on Patreon, you get to listen to each episode early and without all these pesky ads that break up the flow. Plus, you get bonus content and the chance to submit questions to us directly via the AI and Games Discord server. It's all part of the package. To find out how to join, head on over to patreon.com/AI and Games. That's Patreon, patreon.com/AI and Games. Thanks once again for listening to us on Branching Factor. And with that, back to the regularly scheduled banter.
You know what? Just it all starts fucking blurring. I think it was 22, because, yeah, 23 was last year. I start trying to contact my usual people, get some meetings, have a sit-down. No one's responding. And I don't mean, like, they're not, you know, just being like, ah, we don't have any money. It's crickets. It seems that, like, moving from 22 into 23, a lot of people in the finance sector predicted, or at least may have been, their predictions may have been the cause of the beginning of the lockdown. Last year, there was nothing on the ground, but no one was talking about it because the few people that knew that the doors were shutting, they were rushing to get their stuff in, you know? Yeah. If you knew there was no financing to be had, but you might have a shot, you're not going to tell the rest of the industry. And so, yeah, this year, there's nothing on the ground. Like, I'm not saying it's hopeless. For those of you going to GDC to look for funding, I wish you the best. I wish you a squillion dollars with no bizarre clauses in your contract.
Oh, God, yeah.
But I'm not hopeful. Survive till 25.
Survive till 25, man. It seems like such a weird year.
Yeah, because, and the consumer spending, it's incredible. We have seen more successful titles in the last 2 and a bit months than we would have seen in, like, years. We're seeing banger after banger after banger, and users are buying games.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
isn't a downturn due to user spending. Even though we're in an economic downturn, absolutely, but we're not in a spending downturn. I know, Amos, I know. You've got very strong opinions about this. Very strong opinions. But yeah, users are spending buttloads of money on video games, which we did see in the previous, like, 2008-2009 recession, you know?
Critically, that was also when, like, the AA was eroded as well.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that particularly I'm thinking about now is, like, the state of the industry seems worse now than it did then. Some of us, those of us who are old enough to remember when the AA took a beating and all those studios got shut down, whether it was in the UK or in Europe or in America or wherever, it just seems like this is like one step worse. And critically, the thing you pointed out there is, like, the bangers are banging bigger than they have ever banged before.
Yes.
I've said the word bang too many times, but games are bombing so much worse than they ever have on the flip side.
In my humble opinion, the misperception is that all of the large bangers are bombing. Because here's the thing, there have been some public, like, tailspins, but the actual, like, the lower baseline of radiation of game sales, like, month in, month out, is higher than it would have been pre-plague. So what I mean is, like, games were continuing to sell more in as more human beings exist and more people get into games. But when we had the plague, and then the graph went fucking wee! And yes, it has come down from that 2000-2001 peak, but it stayed well above what it would have been if we just had that slow growth. That's fucking brilliant. The background radiation in terms of, like, an indie game from a small team is selling better than it has done in years. Public perception and public hunger for new experiences is wildly... I know, Amos. The dogs have to hear me talk about this all the time. and, like, yes, things like Suicide Squad didn't do as predicted, but it still made fucking bank. But the financing world is looking at the fact that we're not making the same squillions of dollars that we were last year and the year before and being like, oh, well, gotta slash them monies. I apologize for getting heated on this one, but it's the bizarrety of the world of financing bodying video games. Like, this isn't like the the Atari crash. This isn't users going, we don't want to buy video games anymore. Users genuinely want to buy video games. And what is happening in terms of, you know, okay, you know what? Maybe bring it back. I'm getting wild with this one. Oh boy.
It's getting warmed up.
Yeah. It's just the space that I'm in, I continuously see this business model of sustainable indies and it works. And then I see these huge companies being like, oh, well, we only made $1 billion. We didn't make $1.2 billion. So congratulations, this whole studio, you're gone. I don't want to be a dick about Embracer, but did no one do due diligence on that one? Like, I'm a fucking idiot on Twitch. I spent 2 days researching Embracer Group and found out that they have no money. Yeah, they're a fucking sandcastle.
Like, let's look at it in a more positive light then. So like you said, like sustainable indies, like what does, and we say survive to 25, like, but really what does a sustainable indie actually look like now in this day and age?
So the problem is that what I'm going to say isn't things that teams could immediately pivot towards doing right now. So the golden children of sustainable indies, I often point to Strange Scaffold and Sock Pop. Now, Sock Pop is a team of about 4 or 5, and that might be up to 7 people. And they've been making games on a Patreon model now for a bunch of years. They made a few indie games that did okay. And then they switched to this model where they were supported on Patreon. Patreon supporters got the games free, but they were also released on Steam. And they would release them in seasons and blocks and things like that. And so what happened was they have this huge back catalogue. And the back catalog is selling a few copies here and there, like month in, month out. But when you've got buttloads of games and they're all selling a few, the amount of revenue you're generating each month is pretty sustainable. And then out of that block, they've had these huge breakaway successes like Stacklands. Right. Stacklands is a cultist simulator without the stank of what's his face on it. Sorry, it's a really good game and it's done millions and millions of units. Because the amount of titles put out increases the chance that one's going to resonate with users.
Like, what's the turnaround of these games? Like, how long are they spending on them in terms of development time?
If I had to guess, I'd say they probably spend about a month or two on core and then like 3 or 4 on polish and release. They're putting out quite a few, but they have multiple people working on them.
Right.
And the other one is
like short, tight, often kind of well-scoped.
Yes. And like lots of little experiences, like usually like no more than like 5 or 6 hours user's time. And it does mean they can afford to be more experimental, but ultimately diversification is what you want to go for. You know, you can't keep making the same game and ask people to buy it more. Looking at you, the Creative Assembly, like can't keep making the very same game faster and expect people to buy it and play it more than they were. Anyway, the other golden example is Strange Scaffold, which was grown on a similar model. And Zalavan Nelson, who runs that team, has created very, very different projects with small, tight scopes. And admittedly, you know, by his own admission, he uses a lot of... Okay, Strange Scaffold is made up predominantly of contractors working on different parts of each. So the amount of individuals who are there month in, month out is quite small because of the variety of titles. As far as I understand it, I don't want to speak for Zalavir, but that means that the team hasn't bloated from a person to 100 people all working on one game. Strange Scaffold does have a lot of people, you know, under its umbrella, but they're working on different projects. Now, gotcha. When does Zalavir sleep? I don't fucking know, but he's doing it. You know, he's making it happen.
Didn't he just announce another game as well, like this week or something like that?
Yep, Life Eater. Right. You play an urban druid who has to kidnap and sacrifice people to delay the end of the world.
I mean, as pitches go, that's pretty solid.
Yeah. But then it just came off of El Paso Elsewhere, which was low poly Max Payne. With a fire soundtrack and awesomeness. I actually want to point out that Amos, our youngest dog, and River, our oldest, is in El Paso elsewhere and an airport for aliens currently run by dogs. One of his breakaway titles. But I just... We've been talking about this a lot in the games industry of... I learned it as battleship game development, but there's loads of terms. And it is this increasing bulk. Teams back in the 90s and the 2000s, they had a breakaway hit. And so they hired a bunch of people to make the sequel, and that was a bigger hit. So they hired a bunch of people to make a sequel, and that was a massive hit. And now they have a 500-person headcount, and every game has got to make all money, otherwise they die. Which means there's no room for maneuver, there's no room to move the battleship.
Yeah.
Yes, because it's bigger, it has bigger guns on it, but the cost to just keep it afloat is ginormous. And that model was always unsustainable. We're starting to see that hit. Suicide Squad, Kill the Justice League, is a poster child for just infinite blow. Rocksteady mastered the Batman game. And because they had to make it bigger and bigger and bigger, they've now released a multiplayer games-as-a-service game from a team that mastered the atmospheric single-player experience.
Yeah.
You know,
So I've been talking about that game for the last couple of weeks on the podcast because I have been playing it. And like the thing about Suicide Squad is that it has these moments of genuine quality where you see it shine and you go, that's Rocksteady right there. And
yep.
It's trapped in this behemoth of a multiplayer game that I have played 12 hours of and I've not played it in multiplayer. I've been playing it entirely as a single player experience. And it's like, I can see a great game in this that is,
my kingdom
by the kind of economic confines that it's been driven into.
My kingdom for flipping the script for what they were, what you can tell they initially had planned to do with the Batman encounter, which was play Arkham Asylum from the villain's perspective. Batman is a fucking xenomorph just stalking you.
And like, there is a whole sequence in the game. I don't know if you've seen this. There is in the opening hour, there's literally a bit where Batman hunts you, and it is one of the coolest bits of the whole game. You get trapped in the Batman Experience Museum, and it's just like, where is he? And you just see him like land and then disappear off. And you're like, oh God, where is he? And it's so good.
Imagine that as just a tight experience. That would have been amazing. Like, you know? But no, it's got to be this. Makes all the money experience.
And it reminds me actually of one of my favourite little flourishes, which I didn't find out until later that everybody else had clocked this, but if you're in the open map, sometimes Batman will just be on a rooftop watching you.
Awesome.
Yep. So you're just like standing doing a thing. Maybe you finish a mission and you're all standing there and you're like, what am I doing next? And just like over on a rooftop, like 8 blocks away, I'm like, is that? And you just see him like jump off the rooftop and disappear. I'm like, that was Batman. Batman's watching me. That's the coolest thing in the world. And then I haven't got that far yet as to whether they make anything of that. But because right now I've spent most of it trying to kill the Green Lantern. But yeah, I think it does.
Fuck it, yellow paint, it'll be done. Don't worry about it.
Just bucket of yellow paint. It's all good.
The reason why I bring it up is that it's not that users don't want multiplayer experiences. It's that users are very clear with what they want. And as a very good friend of mine who goes by Fearless Sun would say, is these larger studios, because of the financial pressure placed upon them, they've moved to a point where they're not trying to sell us the games that we want from them. They're trying to sell us the business models they want us to engage with. The game's just a trapping at this point. And it's heartbreaking to see. Because, like, there's no external force. The head of Rocksteady didn't grasp a piece of kryptonite, and he was like, must make painful microtransactions live service! No! That never happened! Sorry. And you look at Helldivers 2, and that's doing gangbusters.
For a fraction. When people talk about is the live service model dying, and then you see how Helldivers has absolutely exploded, and it is still probably the game that I'm playing the most of at the moment, and I'm still having the most fun with it. And on paper, it has all those trappings in it that you think, oh God, no, I don't want to engage with that. And then you play it and go, no, this is everything I want. in a really nice package, but it also has a live surface framing, which I don't think is particularly offensive. Particularly the monetization, actually.
And we've definitely driven so far away from our initial points. But it's
we were
just
originally going to do something else entirely for this episode, but I do think this is actually a good way that we can begin to wrap it up, which is really just go play Helldivers 2 and support indies.
Yeah.
Just go buy indie games.
Yeah. And this is what's so wild. Helldivers 2 is a 100-person team, which 100 people making one video game should be massive, but it's not. I don't know what the headcount is at Rockstar at the moment, but I'd guess it's well above 5,000 people making one game. You know, Warner's large teams are ginormous. Ubisoft, just, oh my word, don't even get me started.
Like, 100 people is not that much in a studio these days. Like,
no. I feel that shouldn't be the case, you know?
Yeah.
I haven't encountered any other indies that have been doing really, really interesting stuff in terms of, like, generative AI, but in terms of regular AI and creativity. You know what? Let me give you a few of my bangers, right? If we're ending on a positive note.
Let's end on a positive note. Here's some bangers.
Here's the Will Overgaard sommelier tasting menu. You know, this is the whiskey flight of things I'd like to bring to your lovely audience. Ooh. So, first off, we're going to start with a common, well-known recommendation: the almost impronounceable Balataro, a poker roguelike. Now you've probably heard of that because it did 500,000 copies in a week,
and then it got pulled from Switch. Because they think it has gambling. I keep seeing people playing it. When I was in the studio, when I was away at work this week, I kept seeing people playing it in the office and I'm looking at it going, I think this might be my thing. I can't get this right now. I have too many things to do.
No, don't start playing it on a Sunday night because you will see the dawn. For something a little bit edgier, a little bit fanciful, with hints of 90s super violent comics, Blood West, an almost immersive sim cowboy horror game where you sneak around a perpetual knight doing battle with ghouls as a cowboy raised from the dead.
What? Okay, I'm looking this up though.
Yeah, I thought you were bringing the good stuff. We've got, if you want something light and floral with notes of the sea, I bring you Fight Crab 2, which has a roguelike campaign map. A roguelike campaign mode where giant crabs do battle. But, and here's the hook, the crabs that you raise during the single player are the ones you then take online and battle. So it's equiparts meme Smash Brothers, Chow Garden, and competitive seafood. So maybe you want something a little bit lighter. You want something a little bit smoother. You know, something for a warm summer evening. I recommend you Roots of Yggdrasil. It is a deck-building, civilization-like card game where you rebuild the world post-Ragnarok by building Viking villages. It's turn-based. It's resource management. There's no timers. There's no stress. Jobs are gooden. And last, but by no means least, this is your unbranded Jaeger bomb. This is your red square on a Saturday night. Attica. Attica is one part Half-Life 2, one part Stalker. It is an indie project made by a solo dev for the purpose of selling the assets on asset stores that are in it. And the campaign is one of the best not Half-Life games I've played in ages. And the Zone Patrol mode is a 30-hour experience where you explore this bizarre, anomalous world where, you know, science and magic have just crashed into each other. So yeah, that's the Will Whiskey Flight. And if you need something to wash it off, Pacific Drive. Awesome. Yeah. You all know Pacific Drive.
We all know Pacific Drive is, again, one of those games that I'm just staring at going, oh, yeah. That's happening some point.
It's consuming me. It's brilliant. Although my partner keeps laughing at me because all the people I know who worked on Pacific Drive are all from the UK and not from the Pacific Northwest. Shout out to Paul and Sarah on that. Like,
all these British people working on something. It's like Grand Theft Auto when people go, oh yeah, it's like it's like, you know, Americana distilled, and it's like, ah, it's made by a bunch of Scottish people. <They're> like, what? Oh dear.
Oh,
right, I think that's a perfect place to wrap it up. Everyone, go play some indie games. It'll make you feel better. Thank you so much for being on for Banshee Factor. This has been an absolute blast.
This has been a ton of fun. Thank you so much for having
this.
Me.
We've been threatening to do this all year, and then we talked about this last year, and when we saw you at GDC, I was like, yeah, let's do this. And then I kept putting it off because of the time difference, because it's like, it's nearly midnight UK time, which means we're just about to actually start streaming over on your end. And I'm like, oh God, I'm an old man now, so I can't do this anymore. But I was like, no, let's push through and let's get it done. And I thought, literally, I'm at GDC next week. I can't go a year and not have done this. And so I messaged you like literally last week, like, we need to do this. Let's go. Let's just fucking
go. Happen.
But yeah, it's been absolutely brilliant. Where can the people find you? Where should they go?
I am on twitch.television. I am Viking_blonde. And just for the record, it's a joke about being ginger. It's like, no, I'm not ginger, right? I'm Viking blonde. And that's how I got it. And now I'm stuck with it forever. Just in case anyone's wondering.
it's a fitting moniker, I think. I think you live up to it, I think, quite spectacularly.
I do try.
There we go. But yeah, go and check out Will's stuff. Actually, go and check him out on Twitch, because also probably if you go on there by the time this is aired, you'll probably find a stream with me on it as well. So,
oh, we're going to have some fun tonight.
It's going to be good. I'm going to have to spend the first 10 minutes going, how does this work again? Like, what's changed since the last time I played Sea of Thieves? But yeah.
Spoiler.
As for that, this has been the Branching Factor podcast. I've been Tommy. This has been Will. Don't forget, come and support us over on patreon.com/AI and Games. A shout out to our top tier patrons, our executive producers of Michael Russell and Scuppy Pup. I'm done. I need to go and get a cup of coffee to get ready for this next thing. Thank you so much. Everyone, take care of yourself. Bye. The Branching Factor podcast is hosted and produced by me, Tommy Thompson, with support from Anne Sullivan, George Osborne, Mike Cook, and Kwang Yoon. Our theme music is provided courtesy of Ben Ridge. The logo and thumbnail art is thanks to Helen O'Dell. Special thanks to Shraddha Gupta and Phoebe Trigg for additional production support. And of course, to all of you out there listening. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Branching Factor. Wherever you are in the world, be sure to stay safe, have fun, and we will be back.